Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the Stimulating Program Initiative for Retirees that inspires the what. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it's my honor to coordinate and host this program. SPIRIT began a number of years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it in an online setting for baby boomers, retirees, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents and seniors, everybody who's looking for spiritual, educational, and intellectual growth. SPIRIT has become the perfect way for all of us to engage in a virtual setting due to the pandemic. Today's program will be a very fascinating one for those who are intrigued by the intersection of halacha and legal proceedings. Our presenter is Isaac Tuchman Esquire, who was previously on SPIRIT just a few weeks ago with his wife, Shelley, in our relocation program. Isaac, who's also known as Yitz, is an attorney who maintained an active civil law practice in New York for over 35 years before moving to Hollywood, Florida. Mr. Tuchman received his JD from Brooklyn Law School and Smicha from Reitz of Yeshiva University. It's my honor to turn the SPIRIT over to Mr. Tuchman. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. When I was studying for Smicha at Reitz, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, an affiliate of Yeshi University, I and my fellow Smicha students were required to simultaneously pursue a master's degree in a complementary discipline. I opted for a master's at Bernard Revel Graduate School. The curriculum at Revel was multifaceted, with courses covering everything from ancient Ugaritic to the sociology and the demographics of the Jewish community. Under the tutelage of Dr. Hyman B. Grinstein, I focused on American Jewish history. For my master's project, I chose to explore the intersection of Jewish law and the courts of New York State. I wanted to examine how the courts dealt with issues that are of vital concern to the lives of Jews, ranging from defining who is a Jew, Jewish education, the observance of Shabbos and holidays, to kosher food, and many others. Why did I gravitate to this topic? Credit goes to my parents. Louis and Clara Tuchman, both attorneys, raised me to be fascinated with the practice of law. I sometimes imagine that they added some magic potion to my baby food. It was their law library where I did the research for the project. Understand that in the 1970s, legal research was conducted using actual hardcover books. Computerized legal research was then a thing of science fiction. My parents made me their partner when I graduated from law school, creating the foundation for the career that I enjoyed. For this, I remain grateful to them. Before we delve into the substance of today's topic, a word about the limits of our discussion. I will not offer conclusions on halachic issues. Piskei halacha are best left to rabbinic authorities. Nor will I offer legal opinions upon which one may rely. Your own attorney, after a review of the unique circumstances of any given situation, is the best source for advice for actual real life issues. The journey we are about to take is historical. We will be looking at actual cases involving issues of Jewish concern that were heard and adjudicated by judges sitting in civil courts in New York. Our exploration will not take us outside of New York State, but it is reasonable to surmise that for other states in the Union, all being bound by the United States Constitution, New York's experience is illustrative. Thinking about how some of the issues we will discuss might be determined in other countries is beyond the scope of this presentation. Another important introductory point. We need to understand the concept of conflicts of laws. Conflicts of laws arise between jurisdictions, such as between states or nations, and may be settled by the judicial application of logical and equitable principles. For example, A contract is signed by New York residents for the sale of property or services, and the property is to be conveyed or the service is rendered in another state. Does New York apply? Does New York law apply? Or does the law of the other state control? Using the rules and principles that courts apply to determine a conflict of laws, a sister state law, or the law of another country will either be accepted or rejected. Conflicts of laws that arise between a secular jurisdiction and Judaism are not so easily reconciled. Jewish law, for the Jew, is a matter of belief and is not lightly put off, even in the face of rules, procedures, logic, and equity. The duress of the diaspora has often forced Jews to obey foreign laws at the expense of their own religious codes and customs. At the very least, Jews are frequently obliged to modify their practices in order to make them more compatible with the laws of the place in which they live. In the United States, religious freedom is a fundamental principle, and the establishment of any religion is prohibited. As a result, judges in the United States often try to reconcile conflicts with Jewish law on a just basis. In fact, in New York, courts typically forbear from getting involved in ecclesiastical issues. Yet, despite this reticence to become entangled in religious questions, there are times when such a question is at the heart of the case. And no more fundamental is the question of who is a Jew. The first case we will look at goes to the heart of the matter. A New York civil court was called upon to decide if a child was Jewish. Under New York law, it is preferred that neglected children be placed with agencies of their own religion. In 1953, in the matter of Glavis, a court was faced with the rare opportunity to determine the Jewishness of a boy born to a Jewish mother and to a non-Jewish father. The boy had been circumcised pursuant to Jewish tradition with the consent of the father. Subsequently, without the mother's knowledge, the child was baptized. The court expressed its reasoning as follows, quote, "The question to be decided here is whether the boy concerned in the proceeding is Jewish or Roman Catholic. It is asserted and testimony submitted that this child has been circumcised according to Jewish rites in the year of 1948, and therefore he is of Jewish faith. Circumcision of itself does not mean that a child is of Jewish faith. Much medical authority believes that it is also a health measure. However, when a child is circumcised within the tenets and rules prescribed by the Jewish religion, the circumcision establishes and completes the Jewishness of the child as to his religion," end quote. Obviously, this judge had little knowledge of halacha and did not consider that Jewish law, or at least Orthodox Jewish law, claimed this child as a Jew, not because of the Bris Milah, but because he was born of a Jewish mother, and that Jewish law discounts the baptism as meaningless. Perhaps this was because no one argued the point. In the end, the child was held to be Jewish because the baptism was performed without the mother's consent, whereas the father had agreed to the circumcision. This case is of interest because of the implication it holds for judicial determination of issues of interest to Jews. Although this individual child was ruled to be Jewish, one might argue that it would have been better if the ruling had been based on Jewish law instead of turning on the issue of consent. The result is consistent with halacha, but only in result and not in principle. This having been said, we should also recognize that the principles of halacha, if they had been argued before the court, there's no clear indication that the Orthodox view would have been accepted. Clearly, The argument might have been raised that while Orthodox Judaism recognizes only matrilineal descent, other factions of Judaism accept patrilineal descent. This would have put the court in the uncomfortable and untenable position of having to rule on which Jewish approach is correct. And that is something we would want to avoid. Now let's look at marriage and divorce. One might imagine that because there are many intricate halachic details concerning marriage and divorce, there might be a plethora of cases where Jewish law and secular law in New York State conflict. But there are two factors that mitigate against the multiplicity of such clashes. First, New York does recognize marriages that are solemnized pursuant to religious authority. Just think of every chasana you have ever attended. And second, it is New York State policy to strive to recognize the validity of a marriage whenever possible in order to avoid bastardizing the children of the union. Here are some cases that I came across. A marriage between an uncle and a niece is considered incestuous under New York State law, but such a union is not prohibited by halacha. Some court cases have gone to lengths in order to validate such a Jewish marriage by looking to the laws of the jurisdiction where the marriage took place. In one of the reported cases, the uncle-niece union took place in Rhode Island. Rhode Island also generally prohibits such marriages, but by statute, an exception for Jews was carved out. Since the marriage was valid where it was solemnized, New York may waive its more restrictive rule. Other cases reported marriages that were performed under a chuppah, but without the benefit of a marriage license, marriages that were solemnized by a rabbi who was not registered with and licensed to do so by the state, and marriages performed by an individual who had no authority from, quote, any governing body of any denomination or order to act as a rabbi, end quote. And such marriages in New York State have been ruled to be valid. Divorces can also be a flashpoint. One thing is clear. A get, the document prescribed by halacha, to terminate a marriage does not terminate a marriage for civil purposes in New York. Put a bit differently, a marriage created by halacha is recognized by New York State, but the religious termination of a marriage is not, except if the get is valid and recognized in the jurisdiction in which it was executed. And if in that jurisdiction, it effectively terminates the marriage for all civil purposes, such as a get delivered in Israel. The plight of agunot, chained women, whose husbands refuse to give them a get, is of great concern to the Orthodox Jewish community. Though I am no expert on domestic relations law, I am of the belief that New York has taken some cognizance of the problem. I believe that before a marriage is dissolved by the decree of a civil court, the parties must represent to the court that there will be no remaining impediments to the remarriage of the divorcing parties. This may have some ameliorative effect, but it clearly does not cure the problem in all situations. In response to the aguna problem, many Orthodox rabbis now decline to officiate at weddings unless the bride and groom execute a prenuptial agreement that requires the husband to deliver a get if the marriage is civilly terminated. The theory is that the agreement constitutes a binding contract that a civil court will enforce if a recalcitrant husband refuses to comply. Again, not a universally effective remedy. Here's an ironic note. Many of the cases involving a challenge to a marriage performed pursuant to halacha, but with some underlying civil deficit, such as no licensed officiant, come up after the death of one of the spouses. The litigation is often championed by a potential heir who stands to benefit if the questioned marriage is invalidated. Similar situations may arise post-mortem, challenging the validity of a divorce. If marriage number one was terminated only by a get, without benefit of a civil divorce, wife number one might seek to inherit by claiming that she is the true widow of the deceased, and that purported wife number two is an interloper and was never a spouse because marriage number two was no marriage at all. Now let's look at Jewish education. The protections afforded by the Constitution and the judicial system are essential to the religious freedom and equality of Jews. If these safeguards are not extended to protect Jewish education, Jews might cease to exist just as surely as if they were subjected to physical genocide. The case of People versus Doran in 1950 is of great importance because it clearly acknowledges the acceptability of Jewish day school education and recognizes that such education is in compliance with compulsory education law. In this case, the defendants were accused of a criminal violation of the compulsory education law for having sent their children to a Jewish school where no secular studies were offered, where instruction and textbooks were not in English, where instructors did not meet minimum requirements set by the boards of education of the city and state of New York, and where no attendance records were kept. The defendants countered with the argument that the law was unconstitutional for, according to them, it violated their religious beliefs. They claimed that the law conflicted with their understanding of Jewish law, which, they felt, prohibited the teaching of secular subjects. They argued that as observant Jews, they were required to hold Jewish law superior, since this secular law denied them the right to respect religious law as they understood it. They felt the secular law was unconstitutional. The parents' defense was rejected. Said the court in its decision, quote, compulsory education laws constitute but one of many statutes of a government dedicated to the democratic ideal, which are universally enacted for the benefit of all children within the realm of government. Child labor laws and laws making it criminal to abandon or neglect children are similar instances of governmental intervention for the protection of children. Religious convictions of the parents cannot interfere with the responsibility of the state to protect the welfare of children, end quote. In effect, the court said that while freedom of religious belief is unqualifiedly protected, freedom of religious action is subject to regulation for the protection of society. This rebuff of the parents' claim seems to deal a harsh blow to Jewish education, but the totality of this decision and of other decisions that followed clearly show that when sectarian education is combined with secular education, the requirements of compulsory education laws are satisfied. It is fair to conclude that the type of education offered by modern yeshiva day schools is entitled to a clean bill of health. Though I now live in Florida, I am aware of the current controversy in New York over the adequacy of the education offered by some Hasidish schools where secular education is paid mere lip service. Some problems just seem to persist. Now let's move on to kosher food. Of all the religious concerns of the Jew, perhaps the most basic in terms of daily existence is the need for food that is ritually acceptable. The problem of securing reliably kosher food is complicated by urban life and the resulting lack of adequate local supervision of slaughterhouses, food processors, butchers, etc. At one time in our history, the Kohel, the communal organization that governed Jewish life, appointed and supervised shochtim, the ritual slaughterers. The Kohel also held butchers to account. With the decline of the Kohel, this control was lost. But even when such communal efforts were still in effect, there are reported court cases dealing with butchers who chafed under religious restrictions. In the 1930s, the United Rabbinate, a rabbinical organization in New York City, issued an isser, or decree, that prohibited Orthodox Jews from buying or selling poultry that was not slaughtered under supervision and then sealed with a plumba or tag as required by the terms of the proclamation. To enforce the isser and to provide required supervision, the Kashrus Association of Greater New York was established. Not everyone in the Jewish community was enthusiastic about the isser. One butcher shop found the terms restrictive and costly, 1 penny per plumba. The result in 1936 was SS&B Live Poultry Corporation versus Kashrus Association of Greater New York. The plaintiff not only sought injunctive relief against the continued implementation of the isser, it also challenged the very authority of the United Rabbinate to issue the isser in the first place. Litigation of this nature persisted for decades. Some cases resulted in decisions permitting local rabbis to define and regulate what is kosher and how it is to be labeled. Other cases were not so kind to the cause of kosher consumer. There is a parallel history of legislation enacted by New York to regulate the kosher food trade, the Agriculture and Markets Law. These statutes, as amended over the years, prohibited the sale of kosher food labeled as prohibited the sale of non-kosher food labeled as kosher. Inspectors who were employees of the state had the job of uncovering and leveling fines for violations. These statutes were challenged by a succession of cases claiming that the laws were established a religion and were thus unconstitutional. The laws were intended to benefit only a limited class of people and were thus unconstitutional. The laws were vague and unenforceable because the word kosher is an undefined foreign word, and that the imposition of Orthodox standards was unfair to those who ate kosher but did not subscribe to such high standards. Over the years, the Agriculture and Markets Law was amended to address these challenges. In its current form, the law requires accurate labeling, mandates registration with the state by individuals or organizations who provide rabbinical supervision, requires the posting of signage that warns if a store sells both kosher and non-kosher food, and signage that differentiates between meat that has been soaked and salted and meat that has not, and imposes the posting of a kosher certification form that offers details of who certifies the establishment of as kosher and the details of the standards and practices of the food purveyor in terms of the use of separate kitchen equipment and utensils. In effect, the Agriculture and Markets Law is a consumer protection effort. One may not, with impunity, defraud the public about the nature of goods being sold. The kosher certification form does not assure that the place answers to a higher authority, only that it answers to some authority. It is then up to the consumer to decide if the information disclosed by that kosher certification form meets his or her personal standards. Incidentally, the agriculture and markets law has similar enactments for halal food. We are blessed with kosher supervision organizations like the OU that makes the mass marketing of kosher food products possible. But the history of the attempts to enforce a standard for kosher food is a commentary on the sorry state of Jewish community organization. Had there been a spirit of cooperation and a willingness of all to work cooperatively for the religious welfare of the community, rather than to challenge religious self-government, the whole problem might have been avoided. Though New York State attempted, through the agriculture and markets law, to address the problem, it did not do so adequately. Today's state enforcement does not equal the quality of local supervision by a Vod HaKashrus, and there is still no statutory definition of the word kosher. Let's now switch our attention to the Beis Din. Jews in the United States are not self-governing, in the sense that they do not have a governmental infrastructure independent of and separate from civil governments, local, state, and federal. And Jews do not have an independent religious judiciary that is universally recognized by the Jews themselves, and certainly not by civil authorities. Halacha tells us that disputes between Jews should be resolved before a Beis Din, a Jewish ecclesiastical court, rather than resorting to archaos, or civil courts, for adjudication. Even so, in the eyes of civil authority, a Beis Din is without power to compel Jewish litigants to submit to its jurisdiction or to abide by its decisions unless the parties agree to treat the Beis Din as a voluntary arbitration. If the parties agree that the Dayanim, the members of the Beis Din, shall arbitrate the issues in controversy, the decision is enforceable through the secular courts. To be clear, this does not give the Beis Din any unique status or recognition. It is the policy of New York to promote the amicable resolution of disputes without recourse to litigation. Binding arbitration is a favored method, along with mediation, to promote that policy. A Beis Din is viewed as any other panel of arbitrators would be, so long as the basic rules of arbitration are observed. Among those rules are the requirements that the parties must voluntarily agree to submit their dispute to the arbitrators for resolution, and the arbitrator's ruling must be reasonable considering the facts of the case. Though called arbitrators, they may not be arbitrary. The proceedings must be conducted in a reasonable fashion, and the findings must not be baseless. The decision of an arbitration panel, or for our purposes, a Beis Din, can be confirmed by a civil court and reduced to a civil court judgment upon the timely request of one of the parties. The arbitration award or decision of the Beis Din similarly may be vacated by a civil court upon application of a party if it is determined that Section 7511 of the Civil Practice Law and Rules has been violated. The section enumerates the grounds for vacature. An arbitration award, a Beis Din's decision, may be vacated if a party was prejudiced by 1, corruption, fraud, or misconduct in procuring the award, or 2, partiality of an arbitrator appointed as a neutral, except where the award was by confession, or 3, an arbitrator or agency or person making the award exceeded his power or so imperfectly executed it that a final and definite award upon the subject matter was not made, or four, failure to follow the procedures of this article. Before a panel of arbitrators or a dayanim can do their job, the parties must sign a consent to arbitrate. Sometimes a party will refuse to honor a hazmana or invitation to appear before a Beis Din. Under halacha, the Beis Din may have procedures to compel attendance, but in the end, without the consent of the recalcitrant party, the hands of the Beis Din, in the view of New York State, are tied. The Beis Din may be able to apply social and religious pressure, but it cannot issue a default judgment that is enforceable by civil courts. These dynamics were explored in a 1963 case, Cooperman versus Congregation Nusach Svard of the Bronx. The congregation sought to dismiss its rabbi, Rabbi Cooperman. The rabbi, who was the plaintiff in the civil action, apparently had previously summoned the congregation to a din Torah. The civil court was called upon to decide if the parties were bound by the outcome of that din Torah. The civil court concluded as follows, quote, "The court finds that the persons who signed the November 28, 1961 writing, which plaintiff, that is Rabbi Cooperman, maintains is a binding submission to arbitration, did so as individuals who had responded to the call of the rabbinical court. Not one of the signatories was empowered to act for or on behalf of the defendant corporate congregation. Though the court determined that there was no consent to arbitrate and that the decision of the Beis Din was unenforceable through a civil court proceeding, it nevertheless recognized the power of the Beis Din to employ ecclesiastical power to compel compliance with its rulings." Quote, "The plaintiff makes the point that the defendant is bound by the determination of the Beis Din because no Orthodox Jewish person may refuse to respond to the summons of a rabbinical court, nor may its findings be ignored. The court takes no issue with the spiritual authority of a Beis Din and acknowledges too that the Torah, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Jewish Talmudic codes provide for the imposition of certain penalties against those who disobey the rabbinical court, such as the denial of religious burial rites, admission of the offender's children to Hebrew school, the right to be counted in a quorum minyan in the synagogue, and the denial of admission of the offender's wife to the synagogue. These are ecclesiastical sanctions against individuals which this court need not and does not disturb in order to determine that the respective rights of the defendant corporate entity and of the plaintiff are to be adjudicated under the applicable provisions of the civil law of the state of New York." So the rabbi lost, the congregation won. Some years ago, I attended a continuing legal education course sponsored by Yeshiva University and the Beth Din of America. The Beth Din of America is a creation of the Rabbinical Council of America. One of the principal speakers was Rabbi Mordechai Willig. Rabbi Willig exhorted the assembled attorneys to forego civil litigation in favor of prosecuting and defending all causes that involve Jewish parties before a Beis Din. If I understood him correctly, Rabbi Willig was not offering this as a suggestion, but as a mandate. Speaking from the point of view of a practicing attorney, the idea is daunting. The Beth Din of America may be the gold standard, but there are many Bate Din whose reputations for honesty, fair dealing, and compliance with procedures are suspect. Operating a Beis Din in some communities is a for-profit cottage industry. In my opinion, only when there is a centralized, well-regulated, and institutionalized Beis Din system will large-scale submissions of disputes between Jews become a viable option. Now for some conclusions. When a Jewish law or custom becomes an issue in civil litigation, the courts of New York State must determine if the Jewish law or custom is compatible with civil law and if it will be enforced by the secular court. If the civil court, for any reason, declines to enforce the Jewish law, the Jewish law still retains cogency, but only for those who, as a matter of belief, accept the authority of halacha. And there is always a risk that the pronouncement of a civil court may so adversely impact Jewish law or custom that even the religious and the moral authority of halacha may be endangered. On the other hand, the predicament of the secular courts must be understood and appreciated. Generally, they do not act out of malice. They do, however, often act lacking full comprehension of an appreciation for halacha, custom, and ritual. This deficiency is not necessarily the fault of the court. New York State judges are not investigators. The facts and the theories of cases are to be pleaded by the parties and by the attorneys who represent them. If the advocates fail on this score and do not properly educate the judge is not to be faulted. It is also important to understand that the courts are prevented by the Constitution of the United States and by the Constitution of New York State from issuing any ruling that tends to favor the establishment of any religion. The courts must always bear in mind the axiom that ecclesiastical law is not part of the law of New York State. Constitutionally, halacha cannot be unconditionally incorporated into civil law. If we find it unacceptable for the courts to enforce Roman Catholic canon law or Muslim Sharia law, we must understand when our religious tenets are similarly treated. In closing, let me offer two suggestions, neither of which may be easy to implement. When a case involving halacha does wind up in the secular courts, it behooves the parties and their attorneys to present the salient points of our law correctly, clearly, authoritatively, and cogently. When those points themselves are not disputed, but only how they are to be applied in the matter under consideration, the parties should submit a joint statement to the court stipulating their mutual understanding of the halacha. In an ideal Jewish existence, the difference between our factions should be minimized, eliminating disparate views of what halacha means or requires. In the end, should there remain true differences of opinion, the dispute should be based upon true conviction and not upon partisanship, profit motive, and bias. In a mashup of Tevye the Milkman and Rodney King, would it spoil some vast eternal plan if we could just get along? My thanks for your time and attention. I hope you found this informative. I'd also like to express my gratitude to the Spirit Initiative and to Rebbetzin Judy Steinick for facilitating this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yitz. There were two questions that came my way, so I'm going to offer them now. Okay, so the first one is in the case of circumcision, there's just a comment, even if all Jewish factions agree on lineage, the question is, why should that matter to the court? And because they said the church would hold a different view.
In this particular case, the child was neglected by its parents. I don't know the factual background, but the child was being placed for either foster care or adoption. And they had to decide whether to place the child with a Jewish adoption agency or with a Roman Catholic adoption agency. That's why it became an issue. The judge had to figure out where to put the kid.
Okay. And the other question is, what is the current status in New York State Civil Court of a Beis Din's approved halachic will?
Good question. I would make a guess at best. I never did any serious work in estates, but my understanding of a halachic will determines the distribution of an estate to children in an effort to work around the Pishnayim that goes to the Bechor, the enhanced inheritance of the firstborn male. And since everyone in New York has the right to dispose of his assets, his or her assets, as they see fit, either pre-death or through a will, I don't see that there's any conflict at all.
Okay. I'll just remind everybody, in the middle of May, Rabbi Elchanan Zon from the Chevra Kedisha spoke to us on end-of-life issues, and he actually brought up the importance of having a halachic will, just so that we don't have these issues. So I think that's it. We want to thank you so much for that fascinating presentation. I think you gave everybody a lot to think about, we really appreciate it. I want to just tell everybody that this came about when we were talking before Yitz and Shelley spoke on our program. We were talking about other topics that could be discussed, and Yitz volunteered to do this, and we appreciate it so much. I want to mention to everybody, we have quite an illustrious array of people that are watching the Spirit program literally from all over the world. And I'm sure many of you have had very interesting professions or other things that you like to do that could be appropriate for presentations. So please get in touch with me and we can speak about it and schedule something, because everybody, I'm sure, would be very interested to hear from each other. So again, thank you so much, Yitz, for coming forward with yours. Okay, a couple of announcements. On Sunday, this coming Sunday at 1:30, the OU is having, it literally just came out right before this program, a program called A Little Bit Goes a Long Way. It's Sunday, September 13th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm sure that it will be recorded so you can pick it up anytime. And the speakers will be Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, Mrs. Sivan Rahav Meir, Mrs. Slovy Young-Grice-Wolf, Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Hirsch-Weinreb, and Rev Yehuda Michelle. So this is, you can pick this up at ou.org/Elul. I will also put this information in the email that goes out later with the recording. So if that time isn't convenient for you, you'll be able to watch it afterwards. And they're going to be small 10-minute little presentations. Next week, we will be only having one session for Spirit because it's right before Rosh Hashanah. That will be on Tuesday. We'll be having a return visit from Faye Wilbur, LCSW, who spoke for us, I think, at the middle of July. And she's going to have some strategies to share with us to make our Yom Tov a little more pleasant. So watch your emails for registration. You'll be getting the information about the Elul program plus Mrs. Wilbur's program later today, when you get the recording. Finally, as we are in the month of Elul, we are asking that as you consider your tzedakah contributions at this time, that you please consider the OU Spirit program. Your generosity enables the Orthodox Union to continue providing all quality programming at such a difficult time in all of our lives. The emails that you receive have a donate button on the bottom that's specific for the Spirit program. It's a very, very secure site, so you shouldn't have any concerns with it. Have a great day. Have a good Shabbos. Be safe and healthy. Thank you again, Mr. Tuchman. And everybody, thank you for joining us.